Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
About being bored in the theatre. In fact, sometimes I wish that the critics would go, well, it was just unbelievably boring.
Stage door Johnny. Not a line rhymes with Johnny, but here it is, Stage Door Johnny.
Hello, 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 and welcome to Stage Door Johnny, the podcast about theatre and life in the theatre. My name's Jonathan Cake, I'm an actor. I have the wonderful opportunity to talk to great theatre artists on this podcast, from my past, from my present, sometimes, and in some cases from my imaginary future. Most of the people I've interviewed on this podcast I know somehow, I've intersected with, I've worked with, or I've had some kind of link with. Not all of them, but my guest today is a figure from my deep past. In fact, we started out in the business at sort of exactly the same time and in the same place. It was 1992. It was the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford-on-Avon in Warwickshire in the South Midlands of England. Shakespeare's birthplace, as of course you know. And I was just starting out as a young actor, totally callow and not very good. And Dominic Cook, my guest this week, was just starting out as a young assistant director. But you know how you can sometimes tell that someone's just got it, just has what it takes, whatever that is. Dominic always had that sort of sense of calmness. There was a kind of calmness, quiet authority, that indefinable quality that makes you somehow trust someone and feel like you'll go wherever they lead you. Quite handy in a director. He was quite shy and quite reserved, but just that sense that he'd got you. Do you know what I mean? He was just like, it's okay, I'm in charge here. Really desperately impressive. Well, now look at him. He's an associate director of the National Theatre. He was artistic director of the Royal Court, where he oversaw a golden age of new writing. He won an Olivier for directing Arthur Miller's The Crucible. His famous production of Follies at the National Theatre with Imelda Staunton was nominated for 10 Oliviers. He's a commander of the British Empire. A commander. Commander Dom of the British Empire. He directed the film of On Chesil Beach with Saoirse Ronan, The Courier with Benedict Cumberbatch, and as you'll hear, he is about to direct the biggest, the hottest show in, I don't know, living memory. You're going to have to tune in to hear what that is, though I think I already gave it away in last week's teaser. Anyway, it's huge. He's been working on it for 6 or 7 years. Amazing. And he's a very lovely man, which isn't always easy when you've been that bloody successful. Does not always follow, let me tell you.
Gentlemen of the Stage Door Johnny Company, this is your beginner's call. Mr. Cake and Mr. Cook to the stage, please. Cake and Cook, this is your beginners.
Dominic, you're so lovely to do this. We're sitting in the little office where we've had difficulty working the lighting. The magnificently transformed new Lyric Hammersmith. It's been so long since I walked into this building. And it's amazing, beautiful. And you're doing a workshop here with Puppet.
I am allowed to talk about it. I'm allowed to talk about the whole thing, actually, because it's sort of gone public. But, we did have to sign NDAs a while ago. I've been working for about 6 or 7 years on the development of a Game of Thrones stage show.
Have you?
Yeah. It sort of came to me, they sort of did the rounds, the producers sort of came over from the States and interviewed a lot of British theatre people, and I sort of thought about it and I thought, oh, that's quite interesting because it's rooted in Shakespeare, actually. Mm. The first Game of Thrones book is based on the histories.
Is it?
So I thought, well, there's a natural idiom for this material, because I think you have to be careful, as tempting as someone lucky enough to be approached occasionally about these sorts of things is, you have to be very careful about the cynicism of some of these projects, where you take a bit of big famous IP, and then you turn it into a stage and you go, well, is there another reason for it being a stage rather than just making money? Because I think you have to, if you put something into the idiom of theatre, it has to, you have to reveal something new about the material. And I just thought, oh, well, that could really work because it's rooted in these sort of all the stuff we met doing Shakespeare, the sort of dynastic struggle, the political and the personal being rooted together, you know, powerful families and all the rest of it, and battles. And I thought, oh, that could really... The Shakespearean theatre and its sort of non-naturalist, its non-naturalistic poetic reality could work really well. And anyway, it's been a long journey. I've been over to meet with George R. R. Martin 3 times, which has been amazing. I've done two workshops on the script, and it's really sort of developing. I don't know when it will happen. I think it probably will happen. But it, the next stage now, having got a script together, was, well, how are we going to do it? How do you do jousting?
Right.
How do you do battles? I'm allergic to stage fights. I hate them.
You really?
I absolutely hate them.
Because why?
I have done them, because I never believe them. And if there's a moment I believe, I'm thinking about, oh, how? Why did that work? Rather than ever thinking, that feels like violence. And when you watch it on screen, I think it's partly because you can actually fake it and the sound adds so much.
Yeah.
You never question it.
No.
It can be really visceral, but it's very hard to get that. So I wanted to, one of the main things we're doing here is sort of going, you know, looking at, well, is there a way of doing battles and combat in a way that sort of makes it more like what it feels rather than what it is from outside. So it's been really interesting.
Hence the puppets.
A lot of puppets.
Right.
It's been really, it's been really, really revealing.
God, so, how exciting and interesting. I didn't realise I was going to get this scoop.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's sort of semi-scoop because we did announce we were doing it.
Soft scoop.
And people asked me from time to time what's happened. It's been a slow genesis because George, who is a really magnificent man, released a bit of the story to us. And then we sort of needed a little bit more of the story to get an ending. And that took a while to sort of free up. And then
he's famously glacial.
Yeah.
Books, right?
Yeah. I mean, but he, and he doesn't understand theatre, but he's very drawn to it. Oh. And I think his great skill is writing episodic narrative.
Mm.
He started as a writer in television writing episodes.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
And so he's brilliant at generating narrative and keeping the ball's in the air.
And might I ask how it came to you?
Well, I was basically auditioned along with about 20 other directors.
Oh, that's a good audition case.
And because I went in the sort of, well, here's my idea, and if you want it, you can have it sort of thing. I wasn't sort of gunning to do it.
Right.
But I could see a way of doing it. And I really like the producers. They're not actually from sort of straight theatre. They're from circus and illusions. But they've done massive shows on Broadway and Vegas and West End. And I really liked them. I thought they just had a really sort of go-y, fresh outlook. And they were the ones that persuaded George to give them the rights, whereas many other producers had tried.
Right.
And they just went, okay.
So
but it's been... And the good thing, the other good thing about the evolution, as I said, it's been a long haul, is that they get that it's about getting it right before we go into rehearsal.
Right.
Because when you're doing something monumental like this, you need to really work out... You need to plan it down to the last detail, but you sort of need to work out your language beforehand, you know, and that's what we're doing at the moment. I think there's probably another workshop at least, and then maybe we'll go into production at some point. I mean, we'll see.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so glad I asked about the puppets.
Yeah.
From what sounded like something quite
a bit
innocent.
Twee, maybe?
No. I just sort of thought, I was just sort of vaguely curious and thought I'd ask en passant.
Right.
And it turns out to be the biggest theatrical thing anybody's ever heard of ever.
Well, we'll see about that. But there's been lots of great things about it. One of them being that I haven't done puppets on stage for about 15 years. And because of Warhorse and various other shows like that, there's now an industry and the skill, both in making and operating. It was like a cottage industry when I last did it. I mean, I brought people in and they were fantastic, but the whole thing was a much smaller group of people doing things at Battersea Arts Centre.
Mm.
And now all these people, some of the people we're working with in the room on this have done 2 years in Wars, and their skill is unbelievable. And they do movies. You know, some of them did Gravity. They were being the astronauts sort of floating in space. And so they're really quite remarkable in what they can do. And it's exciting because it's a sort of corner of what we do that's been really sort of opened up.
Yeah. I have a theory, just before we move on, about stage violence. And it's a bit probably the same as you, in that I think, primarily, I still think the theatre is a medium for language.
Mm.
And I think what happens is the theatre is amazing at evoking tension, what's said and what isn't said. And that sense of building up the pressure, like you're pumping up a tire, I think, as you say, when you're doing something that is intentionally not the real thing, you've really made us all in the room think the real thing is ambient, is in there with us. Violence is present. And I feel like you only pop the tire when you start hitting people and doing that thing
with your chest. That's right.
Or, you know, whatever it is, it always feels like it cannot cap. It's only less effective than the tease. Does that make sense?
I think it's a sort of level of realism that the theatre isn't very good at.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And as you say, we know. And of course, you've got to be safe and da-da-da-da. We did actually, we did a show about, when I was at the Royal Court, we did a show about boxing. And the actors actually hit one another.
Did they?
Yes!
Did they?
There was a really great movement guy. It was Daniel Kaluuya's breakthrough role. He was absolutely amazing. It was called Sucker Punch. And it was a brilliant production by Sasha Ware, where she sort of transformed and cost the earth. It sort of cost a year's budget. But she transformed the main house into a boxing ring.
Right.
And Daniel was sort of training, honestly, for 6 months full time, and he lost huge amounts of weight with a professional boxer. It was a really wonderful show. And they worked with, she was sort of felt the same way as I think we do about stage fights, and she worked with a really wonderful movement director. And they did hit, I mean, they weren't punching at full, and actually it sort of had a roughness about it, which is, I mean, fortunately in life I haven't experienced too much real violence. But whenever you do, if you're ever around and someone gets hit or something, it's such a powerful charge, isn't it? It's, as you said, it's sickening. Yeah. And there's a messy, awful, animalistic quality to it. Yeah. Even if it's just one punch or something in a tube station, when I've seen things, growing up in London, there was a lot of that sort of stuff going on. And you just can't get that on stage because you've got to be careful.
So they rode the blows. They would punch each other for real, but they would obviously with the movement
guy. I don't
really
know how they did it because they weren't hurt.
And it raises the question, doesn't it, whether we... I mean, it sounds like it was completely successful in that situation, but whether we really, as an audience, want to think we're seeing the real thing. I mean, we sort of do and we don't we? There's this very strange duality about the theatre.
That's exactly right, about theatre, I think. I think you do both, and that's why the Shakespearean Theatre is so interesting. I mean, the Globe, I have questions about it as an enterprise, but it is very interesting to go watch Shakespeare in daylight because you never lose the fact that you're in a theatre. Yeah. You never lose the other members of the audience. And I've seen a few shows in that work very well. There was a brilliant Twelfth Night there, which Mark Rylance did a sort of, I don't know, 20 years ago. It was really a magnificent production, and you were totally in it.
Where he played Olivia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet you never suspended disbelief. You were always sort of willingly suspending it, rather, because you were aware of that sort of triangular relationship between audience/space, actors, and yourself. And the actors in Shakespeare, as you know, you can turn all sorts of bits into a side. I did some work with John Barton when I went back to the RSC to work with Michael Boyd. Hello. I went back to the RSC to work for Michael Boyd, and I did quite a few shows there, and John Barton was around a lot, and he would come in, and he was sort of amazing. And, you know, he said, well, you can just... Because no one knows what was the sides, what was said to the audience, what was said to the other characters.
Right.
But those two things coexist all the time in Shakespeare in a really comfortable way, don't they?
Yeah.
You just come on stage, you go, this is the Forest of Arden. And they didn't have anything. They didn't have any trees.
Right.
And you go, okay, I'm in the Forest of Arden. Yeah, okay. So there's a sort of willing make-believe, which I think is at the core of theatre, and it goes back to the Greeks, actually.
But you made a brilliant point in my extensive research. You made a brilliant point in an interview where you said, actually, this business of the fourth wall, this division which can't be broken, is a relatively new invention. It's actually sort of up until the 19th century, there was a mingling of direct address and whatever was going on stage that we observed. There was a completely recognised convention. Audiences had no problem with both. And I love that sense of, you know, we still don't, we in our sort of collective, or whatever it is, imagination or sort of theatre-going psyche, carry that ability to be both in it and out of it at the same time. We want to willingly give it up, don't we? We don't really want to have it forced.
No, that's right. That's absolutely right. I mean, if you think about the great innovators of that time when we had what was described, someone once said to me, theatre always used to be in one room and then it was in two rooms, the proscenium and the audience. And of course, at the time, if you think about the world of sort of Ibsen specifically, where looking at a real family in a real room was such a radical idea.
Right.
You know, because what people like Ibsen were doing was going, look under the surface, look at what's really going on within this reality. So it was a radical gesture. But then, of course, what happened was that a load of buildings were made like that. And then we got into the age of screen very soon after that, where we got used to watching more credible versions of reality. And I think both of those things have impacted on the sort of way that theatre has evolved in an unhelpful way, actually. And I think a lot of theatre makers in this age are sort of scratching around trying to reclaim some of the territory you've just described, you know? The duality, which is always there. Even if you're watching Ibsen, you still know you're at the Theatre Royal or whatever, wherever it is. You never leave that. And you can be incredibly moved, but you're always in both places. And it's liberating to remember that, I think. Even if you're doing a play that is naturalistic, which I have done, I've done many plays that are seemingly naturalistic. I think you never, ever forget that it is an artifice.
Well, this is very interesting because this brings me on to what I sort of wanted to start off saying, which is that of all the major directors I can think of, you are the most determined to make us pay attention.
Thank you.
As an audience.
That's interesting,
This seems to be, at least again, judging by my quite, I'm sure, insufficient reading or understanding, the sense that in the plays that you're drawn to and in the way you present them, there is a sense of urgently wanting people to pay attention, sometimes to a real warning, but often, you know, just something that you feel that feels very, you feel very compelled. There's a compulsion behind the idea of even staging this thing in the first place, in content and in form, that is about, we need to notice this. I think of, you know, your great collaboration with Carol Churchill, Wallace Shawn, Bruce Norris, even Medea that you did recently. Is, you know, we are all in your productions, members of that chorus in Medea, going, please, please stop and think about this. Please pay attention to what's going on, because a train is leaving the station and we need to attend to it. Now, do you think we need, in the theatre, are you worried about the quality of our attention or us paying attention in the theatre and in life?
Oh, that's a very, really interesting question. I think I'm very easily bored, personally. And I have a horror of being bored. I hate it.
Right.
So that's probably something to do with it. Oh. And I think we don't talk enough about being bored in the theatre. Oh, in fact, sometimes I wish that the critics would go, well, it was just unbelievably boring. I used to like Charlie Spencer. I had a lot of respect for him. I mean, he gave me some of the worst reviews I have ever had. But I felt like he was, as well as being quite an intelligent and sensitive man, I think he used to write for The Telegraph.
Yeah.
He could be very cruel. He could be very cruel. But I think he had a sort of visceral connection with what was going on. And if he liked something, there was just a sort of joy and enthusiasm which he would articulate. But he was also not frightened to say, oh, that was punishing. You know? I feel that we need to think more and own that it is very hard in theatre to get people's attention. Because, especially now, actually, because of the way that we are exposed to information in the culture and time we live in. But generally speaking, it's much easier, isn't it, to get people's attention with a film.
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about television, because television has its own sort of opportunities and challenges because it's in your home and you can leave the room. But I think there is a relationship between theatre and film in that it's a closed story in one place at one time.
Yeah.
And I find when I go to the cinema, even if I don't like the film, I'm seldom bored in the way that I can be in the theatre. Because it's just the camera. The camera takes you right up to someone. That's always interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It takes you into worlds, and that's always interesting. But I do think it's very hard to get audiences to connect with what's going on a stage, you know, especially in a big theatre.
So you're saying it's more of an artistic or actually personal imperative.
Maybe.
It's more like, this is what I want to watch.
Yeah, I think there's a mix. I mean, I also do think, I think we have a capacity as a species to ignore what we don't want to see. So, for example, I've always felt, and I remember this, I don't know where this came from, but when you look back, let's say slavery as an example, things that were seen as normal, which were appalling by large numbers of people, there's never a period in history where that's not happening.
Right.
I think. Sure. Now, you only need to go to the developing world and see the conditions that huge numbers of people in our planet are living in, and to know that there is an emergency all the time.
Right.
We're just choosing not to notice.
Yeah.
So how do you break through that? I'm not saying I've done many plays on that particular subject, but I sort of feel like there are a whole load of emergencies going on, which we really need to deal with. I think I get frustrated with the times we live in because I feel like we're applying that urgency to things that aren't as important as some of the bigger things. Maybe sounds a bit sort of tautologist, if that's the right word. But basically, I think that there, you know, disparity in the world is so great,
yeah,
and so it kills people all the time. There are so many people dying every day from disparity.
Yeah.
I sort of feel, in a moral sense, we just carry on, don't we? I mean, we carry on with our lives in the West. We choose not to really. We could fix that like that. We could fix poverty in the world like that if we chose to, as a species. I know that it's easier said than done, but and I sort of think there is something morally about that that I'm interested in, because I suppose the shadow of the Holocaust is a big thing in art for our generation. It's only 20 years before we were born, roughly, and that happened. And I've always been interested in that, how that happened. So those sort of moral questions about how we turn a blind eye to suffering and things that really need our attention all the time.
There's a great line. You directed a Wally Shawn play called The Fever, which actually, you know, I have to say, there was a phrase, fever dream, was in a review of one of your productions. And I thought, that's actually a brilliant... Well, I mean, obviously, it's a brilliant evocation of what drama can do sometimes. It can take you into something that feels like life but has this extraordinary distortion, but it also feels like something very particular to what you're drawn to. You know, that fever dream of good, you know, C.P. Fry's great play about a decent man's descent into acquiescing with Nazism, even ending up, you know, self-justifying why he got into this. And Medea feels like a fever dream. Those Churchill plays have that wonderful quality of ordinariness set alongside these formal innovations which sort of blow your mind at the same time. So make you feel like the ordinary is magnificently distorted.
Well, the ordinary is completely unordinary, isn't it? That's
thing.
The ordinary, what we consider to be normal, is actually at the cost of a whole lot of other things. And I think drama is really good at positioning you in and out of that. I mean, a play like Medea, which of course you've done, is such a magnificently constructed play. I was in awe of it. I mean, I did a sort of version of it, but I think the version I did, the script was a version. I think it sort of did drill into the heart of the play. And, you know, the shifting perspectives in that play are so brilliant because you understand why the men are feeling that they, especially Jason, actually, but all of them, have to do something about this woman.
Sure.
They have to do something. And yet you're drawn into her situation as an outsider and how she's been sort of radicalized in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that the moral, it activates the audience because there are these moral questions. And if you can deliver all sides of that argument in that play, you make the audience active and you stop them from being bored.
Yeah.
Because I think when the audience get bored is when they're passive.
Yeah, that's really good. I think that's what I mean. Your ability to the things you're drawn to and the way you present them insists that the audience be active.
Well, I try. I mean, I don't always succeed. But I think part of that as well is that this is one of the things I learned a lot when we were working together at the RSC and I was an assistant and you were in your maybe second job, something like that. It was very interesting watching, these great plays every night, and you sort of go, you know, our job so often is to really inhabit all the positions on the play. And I'm more drawn to that than I am to sort of very authored productions. Like, say in the German theatre, what you get is, and the contemporary German theatre, you sort of look at it and you can admire the productions because they're sort of brilliant and full of ideas. But the problem is that the perspective, I think, often of the characters is sort of reduced because you're looking through the lens of an author all the time.
Right.
And you're sort of, that's just being constantly told to you.
Right.
This is what this play is about. Whereas I sort of like, I mean, it's not that I don't want a director to be thinking about a sort of world to contain a play, because that is always interesting and exciting when it's done well. But I think, you know, you want to hear all the perspectives, you want the arguments to convince you. I love Arthur Miller for that. Miller is the great, you know, because you sort of listen to him and you go, oh yeah, you've got a point, I'm with you.
Yeah.
And then you go over to the other person, you go, oh, yeah. And actually that gives you the problem. I think it's political in a way, because it hands a problem back to you rather than tells you what to think. And I don't think any of us want to be told what to think, do we? It's boring.
No. No, well, I think it's also an absolute turn-off to participation.
Yeah, it is.
You feel, again, like you're not active. You're being... You're just consuming.
Yeah.
We'll get back to this and get back to, you know, your collaborations with these extraordinary people and these sort of extraordinary provocateurs, particularly. Or provocateurs is not a good word. Certainly it's too small a word for what Carol Churchill is, for example.
But she's partly that. She is partly that.
Yeah. Certainly the great innovator, I would say.
No question.
Modern theatre.
Yeah.
Tell me, when did you, Dominic, first... Do you remember when you first went to a theatre?
Well, funny if we were talking about it, because there's a pantomime on here at the moment. So we used to go for a good few years to Richmond. I grew up in London, and my parents were separated, were divorced, and my dad lived sort of West London. And we used to go to the Richmond Theatre pantomime.
Did you? That wasn't quite, because you grew up in Swiss Cottage, right?
I sort of did. We moved around a lot. I ended up there because my parents went through basically several. My mum went through two divorces. It was all. Right. It was a very, very chaotic, crazy childhood, especially the first half of it. And she ended up fleeing her second husband and renting a flat in North London. And she got through a friend who was... She lived in that flat for the rest of her life. But it was sort of... It was pretty basic. She was sleeping in the living room. It was pretty... But anyway, that's where I ended up. But my dad lived in West London and would take us. We got taken every sort of Christmas Eve or something down to there. And I do remember it quite well, because in those days that pantomime had the big stars of the time.
Do you remember anyone?
I do remember Arthur Askey.
Arthur Askey.
But those sort of people who were on Saturday Night Television. It was probably Cilla Black, and it was you know, it was they were all sort of big stars, and it was very old. But I do remember that.
Roy and then Hunt, late and Emu.
Exactly that sort of thing.
Fantastic.
Big production values. All the classic stuff, audience participation. So I went to that.
And were you a family that went to the theatre quite a lot, apart from pantos?
Yeah, my parents were both, in their own ways, theatre-going people. I mean, my mother had wanted to be an actress. And in fact, she was one of the Belles of St Trinian's.
Yes, she was. I know.
I saw the thing. She
went to dramas. Well
done. You know your stuff. Yeah. She got a place at RADA, but her grandfather, my grandfather, who was an immigrant... Not a bright person, but very much sort of keep your head down, don't break the rules.
Right.
He said, you're not going. Yeah. And I think she always had this immense frustration about that, and eventually got into community theatre as an older woman.
Did she?
Yeah, and really, she was quite good, actually. She could do it. But she was always interested in drama. And my stepmother, who was another very big figure in my life, because when my dad left my mum, he got married to a woman who became my stepmother. So she was in my life from very early stage, and she was a big theatre goer. So between those two, he went. And then at my school, my secondary school, which was an inner London comprehensive school, we got sort of free tickets a lot. So I went, we went to see a lot of stuff there.
It was the golden age, right?
Yeah.
Of just school trips.
Yeah, we saw some, and we went to the NT, we went to the Barbican, we went to the RSC, we saw, I do remember a school's matinee of a really boring production of The Caretaker at the... I must have been about 15, and we were at the Young Vic. I don't remember who was in it.
But how fascinating that instead of telling me about some, I don't know what, great accidental death of an anarchist or something, apropos of what you were saying about being bored easily, you remember a boring production.
Oh, yeah, I do remember it.
So I was going to ask you, what were the productions that have made a real impression on you?
Well, I can tell you, because I can remember. I mean, I went to see, my stepmother took me to, dad took me to see Nicholas Nickleby.
Oh, yeah.
The first production. First version.
RSC
I was about
production.
15, and it was absolutely stunningly
with
brilliant.
Roger Rees playing
It was
Nicholas.
Amazing. I mean, I think what happened, my understanding, you know, sort of looking back, is that there's a director called Mike Alfreds who started a company called Shared Experience, and he was the great unsung innovator of British theatre. Mm-hmm. In that he was the first person to do that sort of story theatre. He's a Stanislavski. He's still around now, and I did some workshops with him early on in my sort of directing career and learned a hell of a lot from him. But he was the person that sort of innovated that idea of storytelling with minimal resources, a couple of boxes and a bunch of very talented actors. And Trevor sort of brought that into the mainstream.
Right.
And it's actually there in Les Mis, that idea.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. See, it is, isn't it?
And it was there in the Beggar's Opera that you did all those years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It became not a trope, because it's better than that, but a sort of style of theatre.
Yeah.
And that I'd never seen anything like that.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a bunch of amazing actors with a brilliant script and just sort of again, it was not realistic. It was. They spoke about themselves in the third person, and it was magnificent. And that was the first time I'd ever been in a theatre where there was a standing ovation. You get them all the time now, but in those days, I mean, I think that was the only time until about 10 years ago that I'd ever experienced a standing ovation.
Yeah, why is standing ovation so much more prevalent?
I don't know. I think maybe we're more expressive. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
I'm not sure.
It's an interesting idea,
but
isn't it?
You get them now practically every show.
Yeah, and they used to be so hard to come by. Coaxing people onto their feet that weren't just putting on their coats and getting into the last train. Do you remember that extraordinary story of Michael Gambon doing Galileo at the National Theatre? I don't know where I read this. Maybe Peter Hall's diaries. Dexter saying, "Well, you definitely you should get a standing ovation for this." And Gambon going, "Yeah, well, it'd be good, wouldn't it? It'd be great." And he went, "No, I'm going to get you one." He said, "Here's what you do: you take your solo bow." You walk halfway back upstage, you turn around, you look surprised, you come back down, you bow again, everyone will stand up. And Gamble's like, "Right, yeah, absolutely, I'll see it when I believe it when I see it." He tried that, turned around, looked surprised, and immediately, as though pulled by sort of puppets, everybody stood up in the Olivier. It was just, you know, that was the age of, you know, where I'll manipulate an audience into standing up for you.
I mean, they probably wouldn't have done it if he wasn't brilliant, but I know what you mean. And they did. There was a director who of yore who did a similar thing, which is that they'd stage sort of two company calls, and then in the third one, the music would run out halfway through as if it was an accident. Or they came on, maybe it ran out in the second one and they came on for the third bow and everyone was told to look really surprised.
Yeah.
So that's just the one-off moment. It's never happened before. So intensely manipulative.
So you, the great, you know, attention maker, the great, you know, it's in my formulation anyway, the person who's making us see, have you felt like manipulation is part of that kind of directorial manipulation, is a necessary part of how you go about your work?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I sort of think you can't make it the core of your work, but you can help what you're doing with technique. Let's call it that.
Right.
I was funny if I was thinking about this, I don't know why, yesterday, I can't remember why, I was thinking, oh, there are several directors whose work I like, my sort of peers or older than me, who or younger than me, whose work I like, but who I never, ever feel moved watching their work. Mm. I mean, I can go and watch, I would gladly go and see some of their work, but actually in Britain, I think there are only a handful of people whose work I go and I ever cry when I'm watching. You know, not that I'm.
Do you feel it's likely that you will? That these are directors who have the power.
Well, and funnily enough, I've only just been thinking about this recently because I think there are directors who are very brilliant, but they tend to be sort of cerebral, a bit more cerebral. And I think the reason I say that in relation to what you've talked about is that I sort of feel that you can't manipulate an audience. I don't think in theatre, really. I don't think you can really manipulate an audience into feeling moved. I think that something authentic has to happen in the writing and in the acting for that to occur. I think the artists have to sort of put themselves on the line somewhere in the process. I just think that goes beyond thought, that sort of impulse to be moved by something. It goes beyond the sort of conscious thing of manipulation.
Right.
So I thought that's the bit of theatre bit of storytelling, bit of drama that I really love, because I think if you can feel that deeply for another human being on a stage, it awakens something that has huge potential, because it's really about empathy in the end, isn't it, for other people? And that's totally the beginning of anything positive, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. If you weren't you, do you think you'd be one of those directors whose work moved you?
Yes, probably, because I cry at my own work. No, when it works, I mean, I wish I was more moved. But I know I've done things like when I did The Normal Heart, I think that's one of the things I'm proudest of, because I just found it. I mean, I thought Ben Daniels in that show was, they were all magnificent. And I just remember being in the Olivier, which is such a hard space, and it was in the round and everything, but the power, the emotional power of the play and those performances, every time I saw it moved me, every time. Right. And there have been other shows I've done that have been like that, but I sort of long to be moved in the theatre. It's not the only reason for doing it. I've done many things that don't intend to do that, but I do find that. I think something opens up in the audience, and a potential for something is opened up that I find really... So I have been moved by my own work.
Do you find yourself then chasing that in your productions? Are you trying to achieve that state?
I feel a bit disappointed if I haven't pushed the actors into something sort of deep connection with the material. And I think that is the most important bit of being a director. Because I honestly think that a lot of the rest of it could be done without you being there, one way or another. I mean, it can be, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but, and there have been lots, I know, of experiments of actors doing, you know, actors' companies and all of that. But I think in the end, the thing you can really do, including with a really great actor, is sort of go, I don't believe you. Is sort of say, actually, really, if you were in this situation, really?
Yeah.
Because I think it's really, this is not just true of theatre, it's true of all drama. I think it's really hard for actors in these sort of extreme situations they're playing to really go, really go to the place.
Yeah.
Some actors find it easier than others. Women tend to find it easier, men, but not always, to really go into an absolute connection with an emergency on a sort of very primal level.
Mm.
And that is where a director can really get an actor to go further than they would. And they have to be challenging.
How?
Well, you just have to be challenging. You have to be prepared to put yourself out of the room and not care about being liked.
Right.
And, but you can do it in a... You don't have to be... You know, the old school of directors were, I think, you know, tended to be quite cruel. I mean, there was a culture of cruelty, especially at someone like the Royal Court. They were just sadists to actors. And, you know, even when we were first starting, there were directors around who would just bully.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what I'm talking about. But I do think you have a responsibility in that room to challenge... And to challenge people's ideas about reality sometimes. And as the outside eye, you're the only person who can really do that.
And does it just come down to saying, ultimately, variations on I don't quite believe you? Is there any other way to do it? I speak quite feelingly about this because I remember I did Antony Cleopatra at the RSC briefly and then at the Public Theatre in New York. And my dad had just died. And I loved the play and the part beyond comprehension. I still do. And yet Oscar Eustace, who runs the Public, would come to my dressing room quite frequently in New York and go, just let it go. Go. I think he was basically saying, go further. And honestly, Dom, I didn't think I could have had any more fuel for going further. But I didn't know what that would have meant. How to... And maybe it's simply a question of not being capable of it. But I would like to think that
I sort of think you have to be... I sort of, when I say I don't believe you, I sort of would, I would qualify that and be as specific as I could as to why.
Right.
Because I think you need to give people more than that.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they're just going to be pushing. Exactly. Which I think is not helpful for
no,
an actor.
Not at all.
And I think sometimes you don't want to say it because you don't... Confidence is so important. And people will... You know, people will sort of get there often later on, sort of thing. But I think, I think different versions of it, it's interesting you said different versions of that. I think that's right, because sometimes it's not about emotion. It will be about understanding the sort of wider circumstances of the situation. Or understanding, for example, anger's a really interesting thing, isn't it, for an actor? Because anger's very accessible. It tends to be the most accessible emotion, because the reason I think that is the case is because it makes you feel powerful. When you're angry, and that's attractive, you want to feel powerful. Vulnerability is harder because you don't feel powerful. And often when I really believe that when you're sort of creating a set of circumstances in a rehearsal room where an actor can stop having to think and just be there with the other actor listening and responding in the moment completely. Yeah. And that's where you can get to something that's sort of beyond, you know, it's just about that present moment, absolutely about what's happening there and then.
Yeah.
And I think an actor can then really allow themselves to be affected by what's happening. And then, again, something really powerful can take place. But when it comes to anger, I'm often saying, that's the sort of easy version. But with the anger, there's something else, isn't there? Why are you angry? Why are you made angry by that? Often there's something underneath, isn't there? You're sort of pushing against a sort of pain or a loss that you don't want to be there. And you're sort of trying to bring that into the conversation rather than just having people sort of, I don't know, sort of snarling at one another, which is uninvolving.
Totally.
It's sort of uninvolving. But when you're watching someone and their anger is sort of rooted in something more human, then I think, when I say human, I suppose I mean more vulnerable. I think that it has much more, it's much more persuasive, it's much more powerful. A play like the Crucible, which I did, is very, you know, there's a lot of anger in that play, but when you root the anger in a sense of why this is, why the person feels the way they do, then something else can happen.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, that's very, very good. I sort of wish you'd been outside the dressing room.
No, it's really hard. I think you've got, again, you've got to be as help, you know, trying to help the actor get there, you know?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Okay, that's lights down on the first half of my chat with the fascinating Dominic Cook. Now look, please, please join me for Act Two. Dig into our discussion about getting the end of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom wrong. Strategies actors use to avoid being vulnerable. Yes, I think I know a few of those. Sophie Okonedo, who's been Dominic's great friend and collaborator over decades now, my gosh. And giving her performance up to the gods, how we can just sort of resign ourselves to whatever happened that night, letting it go and moving on. Dominic's vulnerability as a director, he's fascinating about that and what directing costs him. His collaboration with Carol Churchill, which is very, very long-standing, his fears for free expression in young writers now, and how Carol was right in her play Seven Jewish Children. Please join me for Act Two of my chat with Dominic Cook. You will not regret it.
Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. Not a line rhymes with Johnny, but here it is. Stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He sits in the balcony. Sees plays sad and funny. That's stage door Johnny. Stage door Johnny. He knows that there's no